Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Finding your perfect home was hard, but thanks to Burrow, furnishing it has never been easier. Burrow's easy-to-assemble modular sofas and sectionals are made from premium, durable materials, including stain and scratch-resistant fabrics. So they're not just comfortable and stylish, they're built to last. Plus, every single Burrow order ships free right to your door. Right now, get 15% off your first order at burrow.com/ACAST. That's 15% off at burrow.com/ACAST.
Hi, I'm Anoush.
And I'm Stephen.
Alva's on holiday. And on this episode of the New Statesman podcast, we discuss the Labour Party and tax rises. And you ask us, what is going on with the Alex Salmond inquiry? So we're coming up to the budget next week, and we've had a number of questions from our listeners about the row over tax raises. So it looks at the moment like Rishi Sunak is going to announce some rises to certain taxes and that Keir Starmer is opposing all of those tax rises, which has caused some consternation, particularly on the Labour left. So, Stephen, what have both of those figures actually said?
Right. So, Rishi Sunak himself has not actually said anything, but it has been made known through allies, aides and the usual kind of bits of sinning that Rishi Sunak plans to announce or nod to the idea that, well, this is what's not clear. Is he going to say corporation tax will at some point go up and have the vote now so he doesn't have to have the vote nearer an election? Is he actually going to announce that corporation tax is going up tomorrow, imagining today is the budget? One of the things he thinks is that the election of Biden means that the United States will not cut its corporation tax any further, which means that the United Kingdom has quite a lot of latitude to continue to have the lowest corporation tax in the G7 while increasing it quite a bit. The Labour Party's position continues to be that it's the wrong time to have tax rises because the economy is still in crisis conditions and therefore it will vote against it and indeed vote against the budget as a whole. Now, obviously, the Labour Party is going to vote against the budget whatever happens, right?
Yeah.
So in a way, it's a little bit like me saying, due to the economic crisis, I plan to have a cup of tea when this podcast is finished. It's true, but it's not really that linked to the economic crisis. But now, I have to be honest, I am slightly perplexed as to, well, I guess it actually does show the success of like a certain type of austerity frame successfully prosecuted by the right, parroted in the media, and still, even though the economic consensus has moved, treated as consensus by large chunks of the broadcasters, right? Due to the particular debate about how the government did austerity from 2015 to 2016, 17, 18, whenever. I mean, obviously, in terms of the cuts, loads of them are still going on. But when the government's project was austerity, and they explicitly argued for it, this last round of austerity under the government of Cameron and May was explicitly about spending cuts. But tax rises in a downturn are also a form of austerity. The 1981 budget's austerity was almost all tax rises. So not least because of the way corporation tax works here, right, we are also talking about, and while, you know, I'm not saying, you know, this is necessarily the most sympathetic group, but like a large chunk of people who are self-employed were basically encouraged to incorporate. They've received no economic support. This idea that like they can necessarily absorb this tax rise during the economic crisis is, I'm sorry, I don't think it is proven. And I think that a lot of our questions in the nicest, gentlest way are confusing a question of positioning with a question about economic policy. Parking for a moment the political question, I don't think it is a good idea for Rishi Sunak to do the thing he is apparently planning to do at this point. It's just a bad idea. It's not an appropriate time to be going, oh yeah, let's think about the fiscal position. Let's try and start thinking about clawing things back. And the only reason why he's doing this is because it's more politically convenient, he believes, for the Conservative Party to do these tax rises now rather than have to do them in 2023, 2024, whenever it is that the economy may or may not have recovered from the budget. But I think, frankly, that Labour's position, which is to go, no, you need to continue the UC uplift. No, you can't raise council taxes. You can't raise corporation taxes. Partly because I think, seeing as everyone basically agrees, and it's in terms of the strategic opportunity the Labour Party has, which is in the economic consensus has moved towards it, I think it would be insane to go, oh, actually, we're aligned with the economic consensus and all of these other taxes, but we've decided we're going to be a bit more radical on this one. And so we're going to have this argument where it's like, well, on the one hand, they're this, we're that. Other than on this issue where we kind of agree with them. I do just think people are conflating, oh, if you're left-wing, it's because you put the taxes up no matter what, which, I mean, like I said, is an astonishing victory for a certain type of right-wing talking point than a large chunk of people. You're not just on the Labour left. I mean, a large chunk of people across the Labour Party do really seem to buy into this as a analysis of left-wing economics.
Yeah, I think you're right, because the defence for tax rises in the budget that's coming up now would be the same defence for cutting public services in the budget that's coming up now, or at least not raising spending for them, because they are two sides of the same coin. So I do think that reality has been lost in the debate. But I'm going to defend some of our listeners here and some of the questions that they've sent in, because I do think that Labour is trying to play to that confusion in a way. So they're often saying things like, it's not the time to raise tax rises, that's fine. But they then say on families and businesses, and it almost sounds like they are trying to sound like they are the new party of business. And we know that, you know, that's actively what they want to try and be, particularly against this Conservative government, but also on the back of successive Conservative governments that have pissed off parts of the business community, particularly with Brexit, and also the way that they've treated the help for some businesses during the crisis. So you can kind of see the political strategy there, but I also think that that political strategy does blur those things that you just laid out very clearly to the ordinary voter who, you know, who may think, well, why shouldn't, you know, wealthy businesses have to pay a bit more tax when I don't have as much money in my pocket for absolutely no fault of my own this year? I think that it's up to the Labour Party to try and communicate why they're taking a particular stance on that aspect of the budget without trying to play into some of those stereotypes that are propagated by the media and are sort of received wisdom in Westminster, even though they don't necessarily make a whole deal of sense. So I think the Labour Party has to be careful with the way that it communicates what its new, or what it wants to be, its new tone on business to be. Also, I do think it's an interesting thing to pick up on for the ordinary voter, because of that general perception that the Labour Party is sort of more free and easy with raising taxes than the Conservative Party, because there's been a lot of polling recently and focus groups done on public attitudes to tax, and they have been changing. So you do have a significant increase in the number of people who voted Conservative in the last election expressing their support for increasing corporation tax, increasing capital gains tax, reforming council tax. Even a mansion tax has had quite a lot of traction in some of the sort of public attitude surveys that I've seen. So I do think that's an interesting shift, and that it must be part of the reason why, okay, we're not in anywhere near sort of a general election, but it must be part of the reason why Rishi Sunak, as Chancellor and as the type of Chancellor that he is, feels, you know, somewhat comfortable about floating these ideas. Because while there will be your opponents on the Conservative backbenches to this, there is more sympathy in the Tory grassroots now. So that kind of boldness in terms of these policies does mean a lot for how Labour does opposition sort of in this new climate.
I would basically agree with all of that. I think the confusion I complained about in terms of some of the responses to this is also present in how Labour presents this policy. Then I don't think that they are 100% clear on what is fiscal strategy and what is political positioning. Mm. I mean, I think they understand those two things are different, but I'm not convinced in terms of when they actually present them, whether or not they could definitively say, yeah, which one of these is dog and which one of these is tail. Mm. The reason why Rishi Sunak feels able to go move into this position of having the next round of austerity be primarily about tax rises rather than being about spending cuts, I think is linked to the fact people are more supportive of tax rises. But I guess I think that's the other way around. Mm-hmm. I think people are becoming more supportive of tax rises because, well, as I say, if you go outside, people aren't able to do this. But people can see, you know, the rise of rough sleeping, the pressures on their local authorities. But there's a bunch of kind of tangible consequences of the cuts, including some of which are actually tangible consequences of cuts that were signed, sealed and delivered a long time ago. It's just taken a while for them to work through in terms of their impact on the social fabric. And that means that voters look at the state as it exists in 2021 and they don't go, oh yeah, we should definitely have, yeah, let's have more spending cuts. They go, okay, yeah, we clearly need to spend more on the public realm. And that bleeds through to Conservative MPs, particularly ones in marginal seats who are very worried about it all. The interesting challenge for both political parties is broadly, right, as we've said many times, and you know, you've covered this brilliantly on the website and in the mag, right? The political project then was actually mainly delivered by Philip Hammond in that 2017 to 19 period was going to throw money at the bits of the public realm that people who are not really dependent on the state really notice, rough sleeping, and then a bit on things like schools and police, where, again, actually with police, because crime is at record lows throughout the Western world, people mostly do not actually come directly in contact with the police. They just notice police presence or its absence. And then I'm going to have targeted tax relief at people in the kind of like upper two quintiles of the income distribution, so the increase in higher rate. And this is going to allow me to hold together my electoral coalition while reaching across into the seats than we almost took in 2017. And that essentially is the 2019 election result. Now, I'm not saying it wasn't, obviously the decisions Boris Johnson made, Dom Cummings made, the Git Brexit Unslogan were important, but the ground was laid for that with the fiscal events of Philip Hammond. But essentially the political project has been, you protect what you might describe as the 2016 era state, and then you have to deliver a bit more on policing, a bit more on schools, and a bit more on the NHS. The difference the pandemic has made, as far as Rishi Sunak thinks, according to people familiar with his thinking, is that you're going to have to spend more now on schools because of the massive social costs of lockdown. You're going to have to spend more on a variety of other kind of post-lockdown measures. And while the economy is in a down cycle, even if the Chancellor succeeds in his internal fight over the UC uplift, which, I mean, I think even if he stands up believing he's won that fight, he hasn't won that fight, right? If he stands up next week and goes, the UC uplift is going, it's just like, yeah, no, it's not, mate. Cool story, bro. But yeah, you know, but even if he were to win that fight and he was to win it permanently, there'd still be a significant increase in the size of welfare spending because more people are going to be unemployed in the short run. Plus the fact that, of course, we have a much larger debt pile. I'm very aware, if you're one of our MMT listeners, I have not remotely given any house room to your view of the economy, for which I apologise. It's just Rishi Sunak doesn't believe it. Annalise Dodds doesn't believe it. So while it's interesting, it's not really germane to this conversation about political positioning and tactics. If you're concerned about debt, future inflationary pressures, interest rates, although, you know, to what extent you think low interest rates are permanent or not is a whole other debate. Mm. Then you suddenly end up in a situation where if you're Rishi Sunak, you're going, oh, well, the only lever available to me are some form of tax rises, which is great for the Labour Party in some ways, other than the fact, and this is to me is the position I think that they are vulnerable on, is their position in 2020, their position in 2024 isn't these tax rises are going to stay.
Yeah.
Right, really. What is their position if Conservative commitment is these tax rises will go? Then at some point in 2026, corporation tax will go down, some tax relief for people in the higher rate or above, right? All of that kind of stuff. Then suddenly I think Labour is in quite a difficult political position. And I think the fact that not just the BBC and the other broadcasters still kind of repeat this, it's got to be paid for, but a large chunk of people on the left have this kind of, oh, it's got to be paid for, the left is when the tax rate is high, does show how much the inability to land a different economic argument is going to continue to be a problem for the Labour Party.
Definitely, because, and not least because the Labour Party is just generally historically more vulnerable on these issues in terms of the way that voters perceive their economic competence. So they've got to climb a higher mountain than the Conservatives do just to stand still, basically, on these issues. So if they are seen to be contradicting themselves or dropping their, not manifesto pledges, but Keir Starmer's leadership pledges on tax, and if they do face a Conservative Party that is going to try and lower some taxes just ahead of a general election, then they are going to be in bigger trouble than if it was the other way around. You know, I remember, you know, Ed Miliband always tried to use the tax cut for millionaires line following George Osborne's cut to the higher rate of tax. And, you know, it's a good line, but it just never seemed to. Obviously, it did cut through because it was repeated so many times and people could remember it, but it still didn't do the job for Labour on shifting voters' perceptions of their handling of the economy. A lot has changed since then, obviously, and coronavirus has upended some of the norms and some of people's prejudices about the way that the economy is run. But I don't know whether it will be enough to change it, especially not if, as we've discussed on the podcast before, Keir Starmer takes some of the similar kind of lines and strategies that Ed Miliband did back in 2015. So I agree with you. I do think that they're in a vulnerable position, and this upcoming budget has, you know, is sort of the first exposure of that. If you've been enjoying our podcast and want to find out more about what we think, and some of our colleagues too, then why not subscribe to The New Statesman? You can get 12 weeks for £12. Go to newstatesman.com/subscribe12.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Now it's time for a section we like to call
You Ask Us.
And we've had lots of questions on this subject as well, so I'm going to choose the simplest one, which is, what is going on with the Alex Salmond inquiry? Stephen, sorry that it falls on you to try and outline what exactly is happening at the moment.
Yeah, sorry. So without hesitation, deviation or repetition, the Alex Salmond inquiry is the inquiry into the Scottish Government's handling of allegations of sexual harassment against Alex Salmond, of which he was found not guilty on 12 counts and not proven, which is a verdict that exists within the Scottish legal system, but not within that of England and Wales, on a further count of sexual assault with an intent to rape. And this essentially inquiry is to, what did the Scottish Government know when? Well, so the interesting thing is, at the start of this inquiry, the thing that lots of unionist politicians and opponents of the SNP, the kind of like the thing they thought they were going to get out of this was that it was going to turn out that the Scottish Government, including Nicola Sturgeon, had clearly known for a long time, that they'd known before it come forward, et cetera, et cetera. And then they basically ended up being bounced into it by the wave of allegations of sexual harassment that kind of spread across, you know, the world, politics and society in the wake of the Me Too allegations against Harvey Weinstein. What has instead happened is this has become the focal point for a row within the SNP. Alex Salmond, who obviously was the predecessor and former ally as First Minister, is now alleging a plot between various people at the top of the SNP and the Scottish Government to destroy his reputation, even to the extent of being willing to see him in prison for these allegations. Various allies of Salmond within the party have aerated these allegations, which Nicola Sturgeon, of course, denies. And there is currently an ongoing back and forth about whether or not he can. So he says he can't testify for the inquiry unless his written submission to the inquiry is published in full and he's able to refer to it in his evidence gathering. An added subplot of this point is that actually, as it happens, the full written submission is in its unredacted form on the Spectator website. But at time of recording, he has pulled out of his first session because the Crown Office, which is, people in reporting keep saying it's like the Attorney General, which it is and it isn't. In that it's like the Attorney General in England and Wales, except the Attorney General in England and Wales has basically always been in modern times someone explicitly connected with the governing party of the day. Now, okay, a lot of the time on the New Labour, they were basically like, you know, a well-respected lawyer who they put in via the peerage. Obviously, Geoffrey Cox is a well-respected lawyer who became Attorney General under Theresa May, kept under Boris Johnson, and Suella Braverman has a law degree. Whereas the Lord Advocate, James Wool, is not someone who's been publicly aligned with the SNP. He was appointed in 2016. So Right, so this is where I'm seamlessly going to move from trying to summarise it to pure opinion, which is where I think a lot of the kind of, oh, you know, this shows that Scotland, the devolved institutions of Scotland are no longer properly democratic, you know, from opponents of the SNP, and some of the repeating of the allegations of conspiracy by people within the SNP, where they fall down is for them to be true. You have to believe that Wolf, a highly respected lawyer who was appointed in 2016 without any controversy, right, eminently qualified person, has chosen to say you can't publish this evidence unredacted on the Scottish Parliament website because he is an agent of the part of the SNP that wants to do Alex Salmond down. I'm sorry, I just don't think that's likely. That does, to me, seem to be absurd. But of course, I could be wrong. But that is where we essentially are at the moment, with allegations of cover-up, questions about whether or not Salmond will testify. And I think, crucially, of course, a no clear end to the internal battle within the SNP. And intriguingly, yes, it's only one poll. We should never make too many claims off one poll unless it's of something where people refuse to poll regularly enough for this to be tenable. So I'm just going to wildly break my own rule. Then Ipsos Mori's latest poll suggests that this is affecting perceptions of the Scottish government because they are seen as divided. Now, not so affected than they aren't on course to win a majority, but it does, I think, show that these divides will be with us for some time.
Yeah, that poll was interesting. It caught my eye as well. And in all of the coverage of this inquiry and Alex Salmond's non or postponed appearance in the past few days, the question has been, is it affecting people's perceptions of the party to an extent that it could manifest in the election results? Because obviously we have the Holyrood elections in 10 weeks' time. And, you know, the answer has always kind of been not really, but it looks like from that Ipsos Mori poll that it is starting to cut through. And of course, if Alex Salmond goes before the inquiry tomorrow, and I think Nicola Sturgeon is due up next week as well, then that's going to make the top of the news and trickle into people's consciousness even more. And it will be interesting to see how that affects not only the polling ahead of the election, but also polling on Scottish independence sentiment as well. So that's been interesting to watch. And Nicola Sturgeon used one of her coronavirus press conferences yesterday, which are usually quite straight down the line. You know, she doesn't do much of Boris Johnson's kind of flowery answers. She usually is quite straightforward, but she used some of that to deny what Alex Salmond is accusing her of, and sort of to suggest that he's got sort of these delusions of a conspiracy. So it shows that it is rattling them as well. It is getting to them, and that it's increasingly in the public consciousness as well. Having said that, I don't know. I mean, you wrote a really interesting morning call on this earlier in the week. I don't know how useful that's going to be, just from a sheer cynical political perspective, to the SNP's opponents ahead of the election. Because, as you pointed out, Stephen, most of the political parties, you know, can't necessarily claim that they have their own houses in order in terms of the way that they've dealt with sexual harassment allegations and also bullying allegations as well. We've seen so many examples of realpolitik getting in the way of how they process those. And so it's one of those issues where you are kind of playing with fire if you're using that against your opponents. And, you know, I've been told this by people in political parties before, where there is a reluctance to point out a certain party's vulnerabilities on these issues, because you know that if it was turned on you, you would also have quite a disappointing story to tell.
Yeah, obviously, the average person does not follow politics that closely. And I think one Morning Call reader put it really well. And they said, the thing that's fascinating about this story is they were like, it's a Holyrood bubble story, primarily being read by the Westminster bubble. But I think the thing that people do pick up on is then the kind of obvious, and I'm just going to say it, distasteful glee than some opponents of the SNP have taken right from the beginning of this story. Yeah, where you've had people kind of going, oh, when Alex Salmond is convicted, that'll be the end for the SNP. And it's just like, do you know what? And obviously one, he wasn't. But I don't think that people should enjoy and savour the prospect of someone being convicted of 13 counts of sexual assault, because that is a sign that something terrible has happened to multiple people, right? And then you have kind of the sort of like the kind of paroxysm of joy, like, oh, it's going to turn out for Nicola and you, oh, it's going to turn out then. And I think voters can pick up on that.
Mm-hmm.
I think they know, they absorb then the other parties aren't being honest brokers in this. And that's before you get into, as I said in the email, right? Like, so let's say I'm someone who was planning to vote for the SNP and I'm disgusted about their handling of this, and or I'm worried about collusion between parts of the state and the ruling party. What, am I going to vote for the Conservatives and their noticeable attraction to maintaining checks and balances down south? Am I going to vote for the Labour Party, which under successive leaders has handled allegations of sexual harassment so slowly that more MPs have voluntarily left the Labour Party? Under both Keir Starmer and Jeremy Corbyn, there are more MPs who've been accused of sexual harassment, and yes, they deny them, but there are more people who've been accused who have left the Labour Party voluntarily than there are people who've been accused who have seen their process through to the end, one way or the other. Obviously, neither of those parties are credible, honest brokers on this issue. I think the one sort of caveat to that is, because the vaccine rollout is going well, it may be that it allows the Scottish Conservatives to go, well, look, we're more competent. But I think one of the reasons why this is not cutting through in the way the opponents of the SNP fantasised is people can pick up on the fact that they've been fantasising about it. And it's just like a classic thing of, if you're not credible on an issue and you aren't sincere on an issue, people can tell. People can tell if you don't really believe in something. They can tell if your sort of main interest in this row is kind of, this kind of salivating over the prospect of it. And I think all of that adds to the reason why it isn't having the political effect than some people hope. But I think the interesting legacy is, one of the things that's happened is, of course, the final party conference I went to, because it was the last one before lockdown. Last SNP conference I went to was in Aberdeen, and it was wholly unlike any other SNP conference. It felt like a Labour Party conference in a fairly unified leader year for the Labour Party. 30% of the party clearly were quite unhappy, 60% of it, fairly squarely behind the leader. But it felt a lot more like a normal political party in ways than both good and bad the SNP has never really felt before. And I think it's really interesting that since the SNP started to publicly row over this issue, they've started to publicly row over a whole swathe of other issues as well, some of which quite clearly line up on salmon sturgeon lines, but some of which don't. And I suspect that the most important long-term legacy of this will be the SNP remaining more of a normal party, as it were.
You've been listening to the New Statesman podcast with me, Anoush Shakelian, and my colleague Stephen Bush. You can find me on Twitter at @Anoush_C.
You can find me on Twitter at @StephenKB.
We're produced by Nick Hilton, and our music is Devil with the Devil, licensed under Creative Commons. Thanks so much for listening. Please leave us a review and don't forget to subscribe.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello, Freddie here. I want to tell you about a new way you can support the New Statesman's independent journalism. Every morning I send out Morning Call, our daily newsletter covering everything you need to know about British politics. It's free to sign up, plus for just £3 a month, you'll get a recommended daily piece of ours sent to you in full, plus exclusive polling analysis from Ben Walker, a weekly update from Will Dunn, and our featured piece on Sundays. If you enjoy this podcast, you'll love Morning Call. Head to morningcall.substack.com and subscribe now.